Thank you very much. And I'd like to add to that that this subject that we're going to be talking about, or I'm going to be talking about today, and I'm going to try and speak clearly on with the microphone. The subject I'm going to be speaking out today is one that's not, while I come from a background in design, it's not rooted in design. It's something which came or applies in this sort of thing, was developed more for a multidisciplinary it's more of a process or a working process or something to help your work in process. And so I invite you to not just save your questions for the end, but to bring questions up for at any point, to bring share your own experiences at any point during the presentation, except when we do the exercise. There is paper and pens going around. It's not a test, but it's important that you do it. It's sort of, you'd be missing out if you didn't. Okay, I'm going to begin by contradicting everything I'm going to say afterwards by introducing myself. I say that because one of the things I'm going to be stressing is that a great idea or it's less important where an idea comes from than how you respond or how you are open to that idea. And so, you know, I always think it's sort of it's strange when you're speaking about this topic or this issue to then begin by introducing who you are and sort of buying credibility or buying a sort of perspective. But I'm not. I'm just trying to tell you where I got these ideas that I had. I mentioned in the little bio I wrote or the little blurb I wrote that I'm fascinated with the job titles. And anyone in the creative industry, it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek inside joke thing, like where you can't really be serious that's what you're calling yourself, and you have to nod with a straight face. And so you always try to come up with something that's just quirky enough that nobody's quite going to be able to take you serious. But it has to also be descriptive. And the purpose is to describe what you're doing or what your sort of perspective on it. I've been called an opportunity magnifier, and that was when I was working on design strategy, because my main focus was to blow things up, or was to look at what else could be possible during given what a company is doing, given where they think they might be going, what else might we do? And that was, if you can see it, amplifying or magnifying possibilities. Insight lead, this one, I don't know, this was more applied to me. This was when we were doing design research, and I think we actually nicked that from Nokia's Insight Foresight group. There was a Matthew Jones there, and he was the insight lead, and then they gave me the title there, too, in Canada, so. And then the poet, that's my least favorite at the time, but my most favorite in retrospect, because I think that's sort of, that's something we should all aspire to do. And I didn't earn this by any sort of talent with poetry or knowledge of poetry or ability to move people that way, but in trying to connect to our humanity when we're pursuing innovation projects or any sort of design or development project, it's in connecting to our humanity that we can do something that actually is an innovation. First, let me clarify that word. It's one of those plastic words, at least in English, where it has no real meaning. What is an innovation, or what do we mean by innovation? And the way I understand it is innovation is a noun. It is a description of a manifest behavior in society. It is it's not a new technology. It's not a new business idea. It's not a new product or service. Those are inventions. Those are inventions of the scientific mind. They are inventions of marketing. They are inventions of our various intellectual technologies. It's an innovation when it is improving something, when it's taken out into the world and making something better, when it is adopted and becomes a behavior. That's when we call it an innovation. I don't want to talk in innovation, but so that's hopefully that's the last time I say that word. It's probably on the next slide, but okay. No, the title of the lecture is, I was going to tell you where I'm from or what I was doing. Yes. I was a concept designer, and we were doing product strategy for technology groups in large companies. So companies that were planning on being there 10 years from now, they'd sort of figure out, of this crazy technology that we have, what could we do to commercialize it? What might people be demanding? Where should we worked with Motorola, and the title of our project, or the mission brief to our project, was what is going to replace the cell phone? I won't talk about that, but that's a very frustrating moment in my life. What that project became was just horrible. I won't say another word on that. But then, because we were doing that, and there was very few people doing it, or maybe because we were the best, or no, because there were a few people doing it in Toronto, we were sort of selected to lead this collaboration, research collaboration between the art university and the business school, or the main business school with the University of Toronto. And it was a sort of intersection of design thinking and business thinking, and while it's ripe with the normal, I'm not looking this way at all. I'm afraid this thing's going to fall off when I turn my head too fast. while it's ripe with the normal sort of issues of academia, it was an interesting place to be, of working with these very talented design minds, or very talented designers, and very talented business minds, and both of them sort of, as they were, it was always like mixing oil and water, and the question of, or the question being, from both sides, what do designers know about business? What do business students know about design? And the answer is actually, those are very interesting questions, and it's quite a lot, and quite a bit. And it was a really interesting time in my life, and it's partly from that we're going to be speaking. And then afterwards, I was working in consulting in business, or as I call it, business design there. So it was design strategy for large companies again, but this was at a more practical level. But anyway, it was from the perspective, or one of the things that Katrina asked me to mention was the idea of integrative thinking, and to touch on that subject, because I taught at the business school there. The Rotman Business School, which is led by, as some of you might know, by Roger Martin, who is the leading voice in integrative thinking. Is everybody familiar with that term, by the way? Integrative thinking, has that penetrated to Finland into common discourse here? It's interesting. It's actually being written out. In the European design strategy, you're not allowed to use the word integration, because it might remind people of integrative thinking, or they want to distance themselves from it. Okay, we're doing design and possibility today. So what do we mean by design? We mean this broad scope thing of design thinking, or the application of the design process to any given field, not design, but working as designers do. I'm blocking the screen, no? And from one of the, or integrative thinking is the business iteration in Toronto's, or in the Toronto Business School, of the application of design thinking to business. And it was called, they're calling design thinking because they're looking for an open approach, or a new approach to how we meet with the various silo thing. The rough history of the Rotman Business School, or of Roger Martin's thinking in this field, was he thinks a lot of the problems that we have in business come from the way that we teach business students. That we have a lot of issues within organizations, communication between between financing and R&D, between marketing and what have you, and HR. Is because these people were trained in a siloed manner. And so he says, if we want to change business, we have to change the way business is taught. And this sort of this concept, or the thing people latch onto with this idea of integrative thinking, the ability to constructively face the tensions of opposing models, and instead of choosing one at the expense of the other, generating a creative solution of the tensions in the form of a new model that contains elements of the individual models, but is superior to each. And this is what Roger Martin said. Instead of choosing, so not selecting between, or not, you know, sitting back, but actually creating, and not from the intersection, not where everything sort of meets up and you get this sort of compromising overlap, but a solution based on the tensions, the points of salience. This is from an MBA student I was working with when developing the course. Integrative thinking is basically saliency, saliency, saliency. Everything is saliency. What is the salient issues? Which is to say, of the people in the room, or when you get a bunch of people in the room and they have, you know, one's from a sports background, one has an expertise in nutrition, one has an expertise in marketing, and everybody has their sort of their way of seeing the problem they're about to tackle. And everything is prioritized according to that lens. And you have these sort of, you know, what is the issue, or what is the key pieces? Well, it's not a selection between or which one is right. It's that everything is right. Everything is salient. And the more you see as being the intruding points or the important points to the problem, the more informed or more. The more information, the easier it becomes, not the more difficult to an integrative thinker. Okay, another way of saying this is imagine that we are lost in the woods. Anybody do orienteering here, anything, or any avid hiking? What do you do if you get lost in the woods? What are you told to do if you get lost in the woods?
Actually, I follow my instincts.
You skip to the end, you can go. The wisdom, maybe Finns are more self-reliant than Canadians, but the wisdom that we're taught is that if you're lost in the woods, the moment you realize you're lost, you stop. You look for a place where there's water and you set up camp. You don't go wandering further into the woods. You don't do anything, because when people come looking for you, because hopefully they're going to notice that you're gone, when they come looking for you, they're going to reconstruct where you might have been. And the further you stray from that, the further you're going to be from the search grid. So the moment you know you're lost, you stop. And, you know, that has for anybody coming from a business or a business background, where you've been working or trying to push a project or a creative project forward, that feeling of no, we should stop and wait, no, we should sit still, that might resonate with you, because that's often how I feel in these meetings. It's sort of, oh well, you know, we don't have the right information to proceed yet. We should do this, or we should, you know, we'd like to move in that direction, but listen, you know, yes, there are early indications that trends might be going there, but we don't have the knowledge that it's the safe place to go yet. And that waiting for somebody to come and tell you that yes, that's the path, of course, is causes the stagnation and causes the thing. So we need ideas to push forward, or need ideas to push forward. And I won't say anything about post-its. But here's one. This is one of my favorites. Does anybody know the history of Ralph Baer? He's called the father of video games. He's a guy who wrote a patent. He's basically a guy who wrote a patent about playing table tennis on television. And then pursued that patent when other people were doing it. So I don't know if I'd call him the father, but he definitely had a vision of it. And there's a story in there that absolutely fascinates me. It's not the creation of it. It's a story he tells in sort of in passing, or in a sort of a dismissive way, but it's the most interesting part. See, before he wrote or wrote his patent or got his sort of a patent in 1966, he was working for a television company in named Loral. Anybody know Loral televisions? Anybody have a Loral television? No? Okay, well, here's why. He got this idea that they asked him, he was sort of charged with designing the best television set in the world, because of course everybody was doing televisions, that was the technology of the moment, and everybody's doing it, so how are they going to differentiate theirs? He got this idea, we're going to put games, you can actually play a game on the television, it's not just for watching, you can play a game. And so he designed this sort of, had this idea for doing this. And of course, this is the one where he's describing the how it might take place. He actually envisioned it sort of being an overlay or a screen which came down over top and was lit from behind. But the idea of playing games at home on television was envisioned by this guy. But the answer he got was sort of, it was completely dismissed as a terrible idea, because why would people want to play ping pong on a television? What's the advantage of playing on a television when you can have a ping pong board or a table? It's a very good question. It's very hard to answer that question. How do you defend that? Anybody know how they would? Why would you play, even now knowing what video games became? There's no answer to that. Why would you play ping pong on a television when you can play it at home? Okay, so bad idea. Or here's another bad idea. This is Dick Fosbury doing the now famous Fosbury flop. I don't think anybody does the scissors did the scissors in London this year over the high jump bar. Everybody was doing the Fosbury flop. And, you know, in 1968, the Mexico Olympics, when he did it did this the first time. And what was amazing about it is that the commentators didn't say a word. If you watch the footage, like, here's this guy, you know, everybody's going over, doing their sort of scissor kick over the bar, and here's this guy, and he comes around, and he turns and looks up at the sky. He's the first person to do this at the Olympics. Looks up at the sky as he goes over. Completely does different. And the commentators don't say a word. They couldn't even see it, or wouldn't, or, like, because nobody does that. So it wasn't even, it was this absent moment. But anyway, because it's a very stupid thing to do, to jump over the bar backwards, because then you're going to land on the back of your neck, on your back. And in the pits, there was wood chips, right? But actually not. In 1962, they changed it from wood chips to foam rubber. Foam has material membrane. Dick Fosbury was the only person there who had noticed this change, that foam rubber and wood chips are different. Okay, so it's actually a very good idea in that sense, or, you know, or a bad idea, depending on how you put it. Bad idea if you're using the wood chips. Bad good. What matters is the context. What matters is the moment. And while, you know, when you hear an idea, the first sort of instinct is to judge it or evaluate it, or, you know, how's this sort of fit, or where's this going? What we should do instead is thinking, or is to think about how well we understand the context, to think, what is the context in which this might be a good idea? Do you see what I mean? It's the idea challenges the context, not that the idea is good or bad. It's how well or where does it fit, or why might it fit. But what happens? It sounds so easy, but what happens? So this is a bit silly, and you're going to skip to right to the end on this, but there was a movie a few years ago where I got the picture, where he talked about the art of a magic trick. And that magic trick has, every great magic trick has three parts. The pledge, which is when you tell people what you're going to do. I'm going to make something disappear. I just told you what I'm going to do, the pledge. And then the turn, and that's where you make the thing disappear. But that doesn't matter unless you have the prestige, and that's when you bring it back, and that's what makes a great magic trick. That's what makes it memorable. It's not that the rabbit disappears when I squish the hat. It's that he hops safely away, you know, afterwards, and that's the, you know, clapping moment, and everything's okay. So I'm going to try a magic trick. I'm going to make something disappear. Okay, this is the pledge. Imagine this. It is the blizzard of the year, and we are snowed in, trapped inside, until the blizzard has passed. What do you want to do? Now, some of you might be thinking something like this. You're trapped inside on a cold and snowy day. A hot chocolate might be nice. Okay, this is the turn. I make something disappear. Imagine this. It's the blizzard of the year. We are snowed in and effectively trapped inside until the blizzard has passed. Inside, there is a fireplace. And beside the fireplace, there are two stacks of wood. Each stack contains 15 logs. Each log burns for exactly 2 hours. One log makes the room sort of cool but livable, and two log fire makes the room warm. There are three forecasts predict that the blizzard will last 1 day, and then one forecast predicts that it will last 2 days. All forecasts are equally reliable. So make an informed decision. What do you want to do? How many people are thinking about fireplaces and woods right now? Perhaps. Here's the prestige. That's where I bring it back. The question hasn't changed. What do you want to do? You want to have hot chocolate and all this stuff. And it's when we make these sort of, when we deal with these human issues, we often forget to step back and look at it from a very simple sort of human animal way, the behavior way. And the data, or the extraneous amounts of data that we somehow have, often blinds us to this fact, to the human, or the human aspect of it. So, yes, this is Pong. It's not ping pong. There is no question about which is better, Pong or ping pong. It's Pong. It was always just Pong. Is Pong interesting? That's a great. It turns out a very interesting model. Okay. So why does this happen? And it has to do, this is the best way I've heard it phrased, or what resonated with me, and this is what I want to share, is that our normal thinking mode is called downloading. We are in a downloading state. When somebody introduces something new to us, we see it, we try to fit it into the version of the world that we have. We try to fit it into our understanding of the world. If it doesn't fit, we reject it. If it does fit, and to the degree that it fits, it might sort of change or slightly alter our thinking. But we are in a downloading, or they call it downloading phase, where you see the world through your own slideshow in your head. We judge everything. Is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea? Because that's what we do. The world is constant, or our understanding of the world is okay, but there we go. And so we need to somehow open our mind, or to get past this voice of judgment. And I call this seeing. But even if we can see from that there are other people in the world, and see what other, that there are other perspectives, other ways of seeing, doing things, we still have our voice of doubt, our voice of sort of that rejects or separates the other from ourselves. And this is our voice of cynicism, the voice that makes you, you're different than me. So that's why you're saying that it is different. It's because you are a different person. So it doesn't really affect, or it doesn't really touch or reach me. It's called the voice of cynicism. And to do that, we need the open heart, the connection that we are all the people. And this is the empathic level of of design, the think your design process. I'm not sure how many of you or of the lectures have touched on this, the ethnography, the studying or the reaching from another point of view. But it's the moment where to experience this moment is when you're having a conversation with someone and they fumble with finishing a sentence is. And that moment, or that's when you are thinking or connecting to the other person at an empathic level. You are seeing from their, or seeing from their point. And that requires an open heart, that you're both thinking the same. And they call this sensing. But then, and here's why this thinking reached me or touched me. This is the thing that I take from it, because I've hear a lot of discussions about the need for looking or the need for research in design. You hear a lot of discussions about the need for empathy or for ethnographic research, for studying other people, letting other people teach and lead, and not getting drowned in or locked in yourself. You hear all this, but you hear very little about this. That even once you believe that there is another way or another way of seeing the world, we still reject it because to let the future happen or to let someone else's reality be the reality, we have to let go of our own understanding of reality. And this is a terrifying thing to do. This is called the voice of fear. Or the voice of fear that tells, or that tries to hold us against the. And so we need an open will, a will to let any future or the best future happen. Now this way of looking at a problem came from a group of professors in psychology, sociology, and economics from Oxford, Cambridge, MIT, and maybe I think it was another school involved too. But it doesn't matter. What matters is that they got together and they were looking at, or trying to understand why, they were trying to understand human intuition, like why some people are empathically connected to their future or act at the right times and why others don't. And their conclusion was that these people are not, they don't have any sort of secret formulas or secret algorithms that they apply to financial situations. They don't have any sort of inside knowledge that they apply to or apply to other situations. What they do have is more data. And they have more data because they're paying attention to the information that they are receiving that they didn't know that they were receiving. That they are present in the moment more than other people. So this thing was called, the Google term is presencing. And this guy, Otto Sharma, he's got this exercise that we're going to do, which I cannot think of a reason not to do this. Even if you dislike every word that I've said to this moment, don't skip this. First of all, it's not my words, it's his words. But second of all, it's a conversation with yourself. We're going to be taking 20 minutes to have a conversation with ourselves in the form of journaling. And for those of you on computers, I'd like you to do this part on pen and paper or hand to mouth. Because the way that journaling works, you have to, for anybody who's not familiar with the technique, is it's writing without, you're trying to get past your inner editor. You're trying to get past the person who considers a sentence, and you're trying to just write as fast as your brain can think. Like you should be getting cramps in your hand by the end of this for how fast the pen is skidding across the paper. And it needs to be free, and it needs to be at that level. So we're going to be going through 12 questions. Hold on a second, I think I wrote all this. Yes. Yes, judgment, cynicism, fear, open mind, open heart, open will. And this exercise we're going to be taking is this mini sort of you, which will ask questions which are perhaps profound, perhaps childlike, perhaps perhaps very simple, perhaps difficult. But they're questions to you. You are the only person who can possibly have an answer for this for you. And then it takes you down into a moke or into a place where you are hopefully connected with your greatest possible self, and then back up into a sort of plan of action. And this is something that we use in our own sort of workshops and development. We use it in some people use it in personal life, and always. I was telling to Katrina, almost always when I do this with a group, someone has made a radical and complete change in their life, like dropped their career, quit the group. Last week we were working with Unilever, and it was the head of advertising, and she just got up and she's like, I can't do this. This isn't my life. So she was gone within 2 weeks of this project. Not because she didn't like, because she went and opened her own business. Okay, so the other Google term is theory U. So you have 12 questions. Structured journaling, so you're just letting it sort of flow out of you, writing, do not judge it, do not stop to think, whatever comes into your mind, just write. And if everybody is ready, we're going to begin. So I'm going to read the question aloud. This is the only part where I don't want talking, because you should be actually dark enough. You don't even look at what's on your page. Just let it come out. Okay. First question. What in your current professional situation? So that's any way as you define it. Are the key challenges and emerging areas of possibility that your life asks you to address? What do you feel called to?
We're supposed to do it in Finnish or?
In Finnish, I should say that. Answer in your emotional language. You can answer in English if it's okay, but whatever you're sort of, however you would speak to your child, if you have a child. Okay, don't worry if you're not finished, just let it feed into the next question. Next question, this is your key question. What questions, if explored more deeply, could help you to address your current situation better and to take the next step in your journey? So phrase it in the form of a question. Which questions would you ask or would pull you forward? Okay, question three. When do you feel your heart opening? What do you truly love? Just your first instincts on this, however you answer it. When do you feel your heart opening? What do you truly love? Okay, question four. Imagine you could fast forward to the last moments of your life. Imagine yourself at that moment looking back on your journey as a whole, and what would you want to see in that moment? I'm sure some of you have answered this question before. Answer it now, please. Okay, question five. Imagine that you could link to the highest future self, the best version of yourself. The one that bothers you when you do something wrong. And you can ask one question about your current situation, about today, to which you would get a meaningful response. So imagine that you would get a good answer to this question. What would that question be? Okay, question six. Now pause. And this time I want you to actually take a few minutes to think before answering, or think before writing. Stay in silence. Listen deeply to the response that your future self wants to give you. Listen deeply to the answer. And then write it down. Now, question 7. Crystallize your vision and intention. What vision do you have for yourself and your work? What is the way that you see yourself? And what are the essential elements? Question 8. What would you have to let go of in order to bring your vision into reality? What is the old stuff that must die in order to bring that vision, to make that the reality? Question 9. Where in your current life Do you experience the seeds and early beginnings of the future that you want to create? Where do you touch these things in your day-to-day life? Question 10. Over the next 3 months, so a specific time, 3 months, if you were to prototype a microcosm of the future in which you could explore by doing, explore your reality by doing, what would it look like? Remember, it's a 3-month project. How would you do it in 3 months? Question 11. Who are the core partners that could support you in your highest future intention? Who are the people in your life that you know or know of that could actually help you do it? Who would you need? And finally, if you committed to actually doing this, if you committed to doing the thing which you have just written down, what practical first steps would you have to take over the next 3 to 7 days if you were going to start now? Okay, a few more seconds to wrap up. Okay. You don't have to share. You don't have to share what it was that you wrote. But just take a quick look back, and did anybody get, or did anybody feel that they wrote something surprising? Did anybody surprise themselves when doing this? Or was it what you expected? I think you're all on the right track to pursue your greatest possible self then. Has anybody seen this before or seen the presencing or the theory you? It sounds a bit like a cult thing, the presencing institute. I like the focus. I like the recognition that it's the thing that, you know, I find really sort of inspiring is that it's about these sort of, we have these voices or these things that prevent us from fully engaging in a moment or fully engaging with people. And if you, the more you, like this voice of fear, voice of cynicism, voice of judgment, like you start paying attention to these things in your common or in your discourse. When you're listening to someone, you're sort of like trying to skip them to the end. Or you hear something and it makes you just sort of this uncomfortable and you don't want to have heard that presentation. I don't. But it's a sort of recognition that this that we have these things that prevent us, or these things that are out there, and just being conscious of doing it. All of these, anyone who's done, you know, or been subjected to or had corporate workshops inflicted upon you, you've probably encountered some or all of these questions at different points. But the questions themselves aren't as important. It's the arrangement or the way they're arranged to sort of, each one sort of is a little more abstract and a little more sort of deep and personal going in, and then sort of it closes or closes out to practical first steps. And if you, it's the flow of it to trick yourself into getting past your own wicked voices. So what you can do is what you can imagine, and that's the sort of challenge or the trick, what you are willing to imagine. Open mind, open heart, open will, and then, you know, and then you're willing to, or you're engaged in, you're not just regurgitating what you know, you're not regurgitating or making another iteration of something that already exists in the world, that's safe, that you like or you're familiar with. That's when you can start playing with creating something new and introducing something that might inspire us. We built our when we do our method with companies, I show you the whole thing. Like we do the sort of research thing and call them opportunity discovery, and there's impact and sensification, these like annoying non-words, disruption, amplification for technology platforms. It sounds very, it all sounds sort of jargonish enough, but it's basically this. The first thing we do is we try to get people to look at other things, or look at the world around them. Look outside your market, look outside your field, and you know, there's a lot of inspiration there. This one then, you know, user experiences and supporting technologies and different sort of alliances and partnerships. What do we call those? Experience possibilities, platform possibilities, and market... Nonsense. It's about this sort of connecting with the human thing. It's about getting people to sort of run the people through it, experience it as themselves, not looking at the user. God, the enemy of design is the user. Opening the heart. And then the whole thing of the last stage is always this, what do we have? Experience definition, platform definition. God, this is nonsense. Acceptability criteria, knowability criteria, viability criteria for a project plan. All to trick or all to arrive at a stage where we can build a plan that takes the company forward or takes the thing forward. Does anybody want to ask any questions at this moment? I've just gone through something which I just told I do, and I was sort of dismissive of it, because I do think a lot of it is nonsense. But this part is the important part. I put this slide in after seeing I just went to see the Agora Institute and looking at the ecology of information, or ecology of innovation there, and we have a similar sort of diagram of it, that you have all these things going on at once and all these different angles going on at once. There is no sort of methodology to run you through. It's an awareness or the sort of playfulness going through. Okay, but I want to see if this resonates with you at all. Okay, so this is a sketch that we were doing, I think, with Unilever. And it was just a mapping exercise. And we're looking at the bottom. At the bottom, we're mapping tools, things which are in the world, exhaust, roads, air pollution, cars, things that are manifest, actual technologies. And then at the top, it's sort of it's human or human aspect things, behaviors. Here we go. We're just separating up and down, and the organization was sort of degrees of separation or degrees of separation away from it, or I don't remember it might be from a workshop of how these things were introduced. It doesn't matter. What matters is you get this sort of or this sort of mess, and then we did a sort of, you know, had this sort of group where they were connecting everything or connecting the things that they thought were inextricably linked together and creating a sort of a messy spiderweb thing. And then we were just talking or brainstorming about how we would fix this. And all the end ideas that sort of came out, you know, whether they were suggestions of things that happened, fell to the bottom around here. We're comfortable with fixing technology. We're comfortable with discussing things here because it's rational. It's a conscious. It's a place that we're happy having very serious conversations about. But it's difficult to have a very serious, or to put just as much sort of serious in time and intensity into the emotional aspect and the emotional level of it. Is there anybody in this room, just raise a quick show of hands when you're talking about this, that sort of, you know, we're in a university and we're talking about, you know, connecting with our greatest possible self. We're talking about these very sort of emotional levels. Was there anybody who experienced a twang of like, oh, this is, you know, this is a bit silly, or that felt a little less comfortable there than it would have been had I was putting up data? And does that resonate with anybody? It does with me. I forgot to tell you, I'm a mathematician, but that was before I went into any field of design. I was in mathematics, so I believe in this stuff, and I know it's the important thing, but my comfort zone is in numbers and in in charts and figures. But anyway, that we're not comfortable. We're okay with reason. We're okay discussing things that are connecting there, but very difficult connecting at an emotional level. We're okay with the rational, but the important thing, all of this, as you see by the whole connection of it, our connected things, it doesn't matter if we don't talk about the desires, the things that are making us do these things. Because most important human motivation, I think, Ubuntu, it's a Zulu word, it means me through your eyes. And I saw a presentation where everything was reduced, everything that we do was reduced down to proving that we do it for me through your eyes. I do it too because I need to exist in your eyes. I need to be loved. All of these things are about me through your eyes. And that's a fun exercise in itself, just stripping apart your day-to-day behavior and realizing that we're all very vain and not. It's human. Me through your eyes. Imagine and fix. So change starts with ideas, and ideas depend on imagination. And what we can imagine depends on what we are willing to explore. And that's the purpose of the exercise that we just did. What are you willing to change? What are you willing to address? What are you willing where are you willing to let, what are you willing to let go of? That's where your imagination can happen, or that defines the space where it can happen. And it's the will that sets those limits, and without addressing your own fears on this, or without addressing where those limits lie, it's not surprising that many ideas feel limited. And remember, okay, so this is after talking about not being comfortable with talking about emotional things, but this is a kind of we do these sort of show and tells, and or we did these show and tells, and we still do them. Which are where you're trying to sort of move or motivate each other. And this was one that was actually done by Alexander Manu, who might have been here talking, that's why I mentioned his name. But you exist not just because you are here and now, but because you want to become. The readiness to exist is to understand that you have a choice, and you start existing in the moment that you engage in its pursuit. In the moment that you define yourself as separate from this tree, or this flower, or this butterfly, all of whom have no choice. You exist in the moment you find the will to be more than a tree, to be more than a flower. So you exist not because you are, but because you will become. To exist means to take a stance. So back to the original puzzle. Imagine you're lost in the forest. You're lost in the woods. And we can't sit and wait. We can't look for somebody to come along and tell us this is the right way to go. We need to go with our instincts. And it's not about just looking. It's not about just looking at what's happening. No data or no objective data is going to help. It also needs to reach, or you also need to have an open mind, an open heart, and an open will in order to really play with what could be possible. And that's it for me.